accession number 21095, reel 27.
Helipick, reel 27. Did you have any more to do with the third world than you've explained so far?
Well, after a long gap, after having virtually embarked on my career as a journalist in covering West Africa and the march to independence in West Africa, I returned to third world issues in the 80s when I had interviewed the Aga Khan about some of his work in promoting investment and development in Africa and Asia and in third world areas in general. I'd been introduced to him by American friends who did a certain amount of public relations work for him, and he then approached me and asked me if I would write his autobiography and write a book that would mark his silver jubilee as Aga Khan. And I was very hesitant at first, but in the end he invited me to Sardinia, where he owned large tracts of land on the Costa Smeralda and has built up a luxury tourist resort. And he invited me down there, and he surrounded himself with all his senior advisors, including his senior legal experts and so on, and again asked me to do this book, and promised full editorial independence, barring that he would have the last word on publication. In other words, it was a commissioned book, but he did undertake that the elders of his Ismaili community would not be allowed to influence his decision, and that it would be his decision alone to publish or not. And anyway, on the basis of all of that, I went ahead, and The Guardian agreed to let me take a sabbatical of, I think it was about 6 months. And I immersed myself in the affairs of the Aga Khan and of the Ismaili community whose head he was and remains. We're now talking in 2001, and this was, well, by now, about almost 20 years ago, not quite. And anyhow, I started off by traveling with him first to Kenya, and then I went off by myself to India and to Pakistan, and also did an extraordinarily interesting trip across Canada, where there are a lot of Ismailis from East Africa, and where I started off on the East Coast and worked my way across to the West Coast, and by doing that also saw how the Ismaili community had moved from being rather small shopkeepers on the East Coast to being extensive and very wealthy property owners on the West Coast. On the East Coast, the situation, their problems were totally different to the kind of problems that they encountered and dealt with by the time I got to Vancouver. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but I really spent a lot of time studying the extended Ismaili communities in Europe, on the subcontinent. I also went to China with the Aga Khan, where he went in search of Ismailis up in Xinjiang, and we went to Kashgar, as well as to Beijing. And I saw a great deal and learned a great deal, both about who and what the Ismailis were and what their beliefs and...
Who are the Ismailis?
Well, the Ismailis are Muslims. They are descendants of Muhammad. They are Shia Muslims. they are organized, they're a very liberal expression of Islam, far more liberal than I think any other Muslims. They abolished, goodness, marrying more than four wives. I mean, marrying more, I mean, they're monogamous. Their women work, do not cover their heads. They're organized in much the same way as Jewish communities are, with elected or selected community heads and hierarchies through which they work. They are mostly of Asian origin, though there are some, there are a small number of blacks, but on the whole, their roots are in the Middle East and later on the subcontinent. They are controversial amongst other Muslim sects, and they have a tradition of hiding their religious identity as a kind of auto-defense against attack. The Aga Khan is often described as their god, which he certainly is not. He is a descendant of a breakaway faction of the Shia Muslims, but he is their leader. He's also often his wealth, and of course he is known to be very wealthy, but probably not as wealthy as he's assumed to be. It is widely assumed that his wealth derives from the contributions made by the Ismailis to their imam. In fact, I soon discovered it was very much the other way around, that he devoted a great deal of his wealth to investment and to projects both within the Ismaili community and what he above all has been trying to promote, which is cooperation between Ismaili communities and the countries where they live. They are dispersed, again, it's like the Jews. I mean, they have no country, and the only area in the world where they form the majority is in the northern territories of Pakistan, in Hunza, where they are the majority. And incidentally, I have been up there and visited them, and it is a very remarkable achievement what has been done there by the Aga Khan's institutions, because for one thing, education has the highest priority in everything that happens in that community. You go through these very remote villages up in the mountains, and you see the boys and girls at school, winning scholarships to colleges, and even coming back to work and to invest in the areas where they come from. They speak fluent up there. They speak fluent English as well as their own languages. They have introduced the most remarkable irrigation systems, so that they have really made very barren lands quite fertile. And I discovered, to my amazement, that one of the things that is being done in Hunza now is to grow Desiree potatoes. Now that is a very high class potato whose origin, which is grown in Europe, in the Netherlands. The Netherlands have given seeds to the areas up in Hunza, and they now supply a great deal of Pakistan with the Desiree potatoes that are grown up in these remote valleys in Hunza. And all of this is now being done on an organized commercial scale, and it is very impressive. Equally, they have planted all manner of fruit trees. Before the one, it was almost virtually a monoculture of apricots. apricots are still grown there and remain delicious, but they do also grow apples and all kinds of other fruit. And this is just a small example of the kind of development. This is all done through cooperatives, and there is an Aga Khan development institution, but it really is a quite remarkable achievement. And there one can see on a sort of relatively small scale, because it doesn't involve that many thousands of people, what can be achieved if you have a really highly motivated community, if you place great emphasis on education, also on health services. There are clinics up there. It's almost a model of how you can transform remote and probably quite uneducated population into something productive, and also an institution which is capable of persuading the young who have received education elsewhere, often college education, to come back and to apply the skills that they've learned to the communities from where they have their roots.
Has the war in that area undermined this at all, do you know?
Not at all, because it's far enough away from Kashmir not to be affected by it at all.
And Afghanistan,
I mean, this is a different area. This borders on to China, to Xinjiang. It's the Karakorams. Gilgit has experienced its problems, and there are factional problems between Sunnis and Shias in Gilgit, which is the capital of the northern provinces. But up in Hunza, that is very peaceful indeed, and has become very much, is developing tourism now on a slightly bigger scale than when I first went there. But there is quite a lot of tourism there, and it is the most beautiful part of the world I think I've ever seen, so it's highly recommendable.
And that is Hunza.
That's Hunza, yeah. Hunza. But that is the Ismaili community in its purest form. But of course, where it was much more interesting in terms of how the Ismailis have tried to survive, often in amongst people who were very suspicious of them. I found Kenya obviously very interesting, because Kenya has a large Asian population, and quite a few of them are Ismailis. The Aga Khan owned the principal newspaper, The Nation, which of course gave him a great deal of influence. But he constantly emphasized that the Ismaili communities must do more than look after themselves, that it was absolutely their duty to promote development and and understanding between all the populations of Kenya. To some extent, this was a survival; it was a defensive policy. But that was the sort of key element, that they must use their money and their wealth, and they were wealthy because they're so motivated and so good. On the whole, they tended to own insurance companies and investment corporations and so on, that they must devote their energies and their resources and their capital towards the general development of the areas in which they lived. Of course, they had been present massively in Uganda. They were expelled by Idi Amin. Some came to Europe, and I met quite a number of very wealthy individuals in Britain, in France, Portugal, all over Europe, who had settled down extremely well and had made a great deal of themselves. But others, and that was the interesting aspect of the trip to Canada, emigrated to Canada, which was more prepared than the United States, and indeed Britain, to take in large numbers of the Uganda Asians. And again, there they had integrated well. They are integrationists by almost by definition, they do not attempt to keep themselves separate, except, and that of course was beginning to be the great problem in a country like Canada, that on the whole, Ismailis were expected to marry Ismailis, and in Canada you saw the beginnings of dissent there, that the young were marrying out, and that had become a very troubling phenomenon already when I was doing this tour across across Canada. But as I said, it was for me fascinating that I started off by talking to small shopkeepers and some small supermarkets in Montreal. In Toronto, I was already talking to quite a number of professionals. I then went on to Calgary, where they were beginning to be in property. Then I went to Edmonton, where a lot of them were professionals working in the administration of the state. And by the time I got to Vancouver, as I say, they were wealthy entrepreneurs, owned a great deal of property. And the one big problem they had was to find adequate parking space for their cars when they went to their Jamaat Khana, which is the name that they give to their mosques. So that was a really interesting sociological study, which I hope someone else has done in far greater depth than I did. In India, there were a great many Ismailis in Bombay and in Gujarat, and there they were still very, very poor for the most part. The Aga Khan never knew, it was often said that he was the leader of 12 million Ismailis. I don't think that nowhere near as large as that, and I remember sitting down once actually with the leader of the community in Canada, who was an extremely erudite and attractive man, and we tried to sort of add up the size of the various Ismaili communities, and I think it worked out at under a million. Well, nobody knows exactly how many of them there are, and I saw that most clearly of all when we went to China, to Xinjiang, where first the Aga Khan actually had a symposium in Beijing on mud architecture. Architecture is one of his great interests. He has a lot in common with Prince Charles. And his sort of great ambition, and he gives prizes, there's an Aga Khan Award for Architecture. His aim is to translate traditional architecture of the various countries where the Ismailis are into contemporary buildings, incorporating traditional features, including the circulation of air and water and so on and so forth, with the demands of modern technology and so on. And one of the things the symposium in China was connected with that architectural award, and brought together architects, sociologists, anthropologists, engineers and so on, to discuss how traditional mud architecture could be translated into contemporary housing. And that in itself, of course, is very interesting, and what was also fascinating was to observe the sort of Chinese, senior Chinese officials who participated and followed this, because they really knew nothing about the Aga Khan, as far as I could make out, except that they saw that he was a very wealthy man. And so, he was, I think we were there for about 2 weeks, and hardly a day went by where there wasn't a big Chinese feast, but it turned out whether it was sponsored by the government or by him, he was always the one who was paying for these things. But anyway, we ended up in Kashgar, which is the capital of Xinjiang, where there is a large Muslim population. And the Aga Khan was convinced that in that area, given the history of the migration of the Ismailis from Persia, that there were Ismailis up there. From the little that I could observe, because the Cultural Revolution was still very much was behind them, but the the impact of the Cultural Revolution was still very much present. And I had a feeling that you were lucky if you talked to one of the Muslims up there, if they knew whether they were Shias or Sunnis, but whether any of them really knew that they were Ismailis, I thought was pretty remote. But anyway, he became convinced that he could identify Ismailis, and certainly he followed up his visit with quite large amounts of money to build a hotel and to rebuild derelict mosques and so on and so forth. So he left something behind. I remember it's at the time there were no hotels to stay in Kashgar, and we were all put up in a student's hostel, and which was a pretty unusual thing for the Aga Khan to happen to him anyhow. But he was one of the, alleged to be one of the fortunate ones, that he was going to have a shower. The only point, the trouble was that he went into the shower and discovered that it was full of rats. So that was not it was probably one of his more memorable experiences, but certainly not one of the highlights of his existence. But anyway, it was very interesting, and I came back to Kashgar in, I think, in 97 on a rather extensive holiday, and Kashgar, in terms of hotels, had really been transformed, because now it boasted two or three adequate hotels, and one of them being a hotel which had been financed by the Ismaili, by the Aga Khan. So that is a remembrance of his visit there, plus some really terrible restoration work that was being done in the mosques, which I think, had he seen what was being done to them, he would have been extremely upset. But that's where it is.
With all the interest on Islam, you know, since the end of the Cold War, one doesn't hear much about the Ismaili group.
Well, he keeps a very low profile, because he thinks that is the best way of ensuring their continued survival and viability in an area, in an era of where fundamentalism, after all, is putting a great deal of pressure onto Muslims of a very moderate character, such as the Ismailis. And I think that is a major problem. Then, I mean, if you look at Kenya, the regime there is not all that friendly towards its Asian community. So again, ample reason for keeping a low profile and just beavering away doing the kind of work that they were doing, trying to be cooperative, helpful, investing money, and so on. In India, the task is much bigger than anywhere else in terms of helping Ismailis, because some of them, as I said, are extremely poor. I remember in Bombay, for example, visiting farmers who bring their cows into Bombay during the for parts of the year, where they literally live in stalls with the cows. I mean, it is not an easy life. So again, I think he's always conscious, the Aga Khan, of the of potential communal strife, and again, there's every argument for keeping a low profile. And again, in Pakistan, he was already very concerned for the fate of the Ismailis while President Zia was still alive, because he was increasingly acting against the Shias, who are a minority in Pakistan. And I can only assume, and I'm not in touch with him now, that he feels even more apprehensive about what the present military regime might or might not do to the Ismailis. So I think in the West and in Canada and so on, you hear little about them, because they are really very integrated into the countries where they're living and prospering. And in the poorer countries, all that they can really usefully do is to beaver away, trying to improve the economics and social and life of the communities in which they live, and also helping to promote health services, schools and so on, all of which they do quietly without fanfare.
And did you publish your book? Was your book published?
No, the book was not published because, unfortunately, the Aga Khan didn't keep his word. He, in the end, gave the draft book to the leaders of the Ismaili community, and they were very astonished when they realized how freely he had spoken to me about the kind of problems that he had encountered when he first became the Imam, the Aga Khan, and the problems that he'd had in convincing the elders of the community that they must move into modern times and so on and so forth. And they produced a book of comments that was almost longer than my manuscript. And even though the book was about to be published and it was already on the list of Collins who were going to be the publishers, he just put a hold on to the whole proceeding, and the book was never published. And I remain very sad about that. And I've shown the manuscript to a number of people who including publishers, who would love to publish the book, but are just too afraid of litigation, because I had a contract, and the contract said that the book had to, the publication had to be approved by the Aga Khan, and after more than 10 years, well, 15 years now, a lot of the material is out of date anyway, and it would have to be updated, and I couldn't update it without cooperation. I have, on a couple of occasions, approached the Aga Khan's people to see if he would be prepared to let me do that, and he just hasn't responded, so I just have to assume he doesn't want it done. But it has a lot to do with his change of mind about drawing attention to the community. Yes, obviously I have the manuscript, but I also have the first draft of the book, which I sent to the Aga Khan to look at for his comments, and I have the complete set of all the chapters with his comments, most of which were highly favorable. But the point about it is that it is all in his own handwriting, and as I observed from traveling with him, he only had to touch a glass of water and that glass of water became a museum piece, or he had to drive a car and you would know that that car would probably never leave its garage again. So I realized that I'm sitting on something quite valuable, because a lot of Ismailis would certainly give a great deal to possess either certainly the manuscript in its entirety or even just odd pages, but there's absolutely nothing I can do about that. It's like having a stolen Rembrandt and not being able to dispose of it. I think perhaps it's worth just emphasizing that my interest in doing this book was obviously by itself, the notion of being close to the Aga Khan is sort of something rather special, because he's such a sort of larger-than-life figure, really. But what I've really enjoyed and valued was just simply to have another shot at trying to understand the problems of transition of the Third World and development issues, and to see the extent to which the whole approach to Third World development issues had advanced since my first experience of it in the late 50s and early 60s. What the Aga Khan was doing, continues to do, is a highly sophisticated approach where he tries to combine private capital with the know-how and expertise of World Bank resources and other of the international institutions, where he tries to bring in experts to teach expertise, and altogether to create seed investment that would then lead on to more and more investment. Obviously, the approach also has its limitations, because especially because the World Bank has its limitations and the United Nations institutions have their limitations. Nevertheless, the kind of overall comprehensive approach, which also takes account of educational facilities, of health.